Blog Talk Radio.
Be Unique Radio brings you unscripted conversations with world changers and difference makers Thursday nights at 9 p.m. Eastern Time on all your favorite platforms. Visit BeUnique.org to learn who is scheduled next and how you can talk with our guests and become part of the show. That's BeUnique.org. See you there.
Yay, we have a new intro. That was Jennifer.
Yeah.
I did it again. I said, My husband heard my podcast the other day, and he goes, you say too much, Mary. I'll work on that. I've only been doing this for 9 months. I'm excited to be here, though, because it's Thursday, and Thursday's always our longer show. Gene and I work together on a daily 15-minute break, and we could talk forever. But tonight, we're here with Scott Neustock. He's a professor of English, and he's the founding director of the Pierce Shakespeare Endowment at Rhodes College. He wrote a book, plain and simple. I read it. I'm in love. There's so many things that I could talk about, but I think I'm just going to say welcome to the show, Scott.
Thank you, Mary. Thank you, Gene. It's good to be here.
Yes, welcome, sir. Excellent.
I know that in your book you had stated, there goes that again. It's human to avoid the hard work of thinking, reading, and writing, but we all fail when technology becomes a distraction from, or worse, a substitute for the interminable, I'm having trouble here tonight, yet rewarding task of confronting the object under study, seeing the world in a grain of sand. And it's so true that you can see the world in a grain of sand if you just look for it.
Yeah, that's a wonderful line from the great early 19th century poet William Blake, which has that kind of sense that if you look closely, if you concentrate enough on the local thing, that can open up larger patterns for you to recognize in the world around you. So I love Blake. I love lots of different writers, and I was trying to weave them as much as I could into the book.
Oh, you did.
Throughout.
The title of your book is kind of deceptive because it's How to Think Like Shakespeare. And so when I picked up the book, I thought, oh, this is going to be the bard just talking to me left and right. And it is, but it's not. It's more about how to think critically, how to think. There was a section in there about kindness I found, and I just wrapped my head around it. But there are so many little nuggets of wisdom that you've pulled from so many amazing people. How long did it take you to write this?
Well, that's a great question because, you know, technically I started the writing of the book 4 years ago now, but in some ways it really distills all of the thinking and teaching that I've been doing for over 25 years now, because a lot of those quotations or a lot of the insights came out of my classroom experience, came out of me being in conversation with students and being excited to share things with them or wanting to have them read a particular poem and see what they thought about it. And in a way, the chance to write the book gave me the opportunity to synthesize a lot of my teaching materials that go back for a couple of decades. But officially, the book began in its official form as a speech that I gave to the incoming class at Rhodes College in 2016. And then it turned into a short essay. And then I proposed a book to expand upon that essay. But in some ways, it really does distill everything I love about teaching and reading over my career so far.
That makes a lot of sense to me because I've been working on several books for several years. And every time I think they're just about ready, I think, oh, man, I've got to add this in there.
Was
that an issue for you that you kept thinking I have to add more?
Yes, no, I am entirely on the same page with you, Mary. I probably have 20 times as much material that I could have put into the book in terms of the kind of large working file that I was assembling over the years. I was
I was trying as hard as I could to distill whatever wisdom I'd been able to accumulate into the most concise form. So it's a short book. That there are 14 chapters that are only about, you know, maybe 8 or 10 pages each.
Mm-hmm.
Though the chapters are fairly dense. You know, we were discussing before the program started, there are sometimes in a single paragraph you'll have 3 or 5 quotations from different writers from different centuries, from different nations, different geographies across the globe. So I tried to boil down everything that I love about teaching and writing and thinking into something that seemed accessible, but still could also open doors or open other pathways for further reading and further thought. So I work hard to make it not seem like this is the last word on Shakespeare or the last word on thinking, but rather assembling some really smart and interesting people and hoping that those will spark further thought in readers and further reading for them as well.
Well,
sure.
like a true educator. Right.
Yeah.
But yeah. As a true educator, not just a teacher or a person who holds tenure at a college, you are an educator. And that's what educators do. They tender the spark of imagination and curiosity so that when they finish reading or studying a particular course, they want to go out and know more.
Yeah, I hope so. I really hope so. In fact, I think that's probably the highest compliment that I've received about the book is a number of readers have said, you know, I enjoyed the book, but what I really loved were the reading suggestions that you made. Like, I feel like I've got a whole lifetime of further reading to do. And if there's a reader or a student who's eager to learn more, that's always a thrill for an educator. And definitely I one of the things I was thinking through as I was assembling the book was ways to make those suggestions about possible further avenues for thought while trying really hard not to be dogmatic or pedantic about it. You know, I try to serve them up without saying you have to read this, but saying, like, if you like this, you probably will like this, or this could be another way to conceive of it. So I did that in a couple of ways. One was just assembling all of these quotations and distilling them into the thematically arranged chapters. Another way was through the design of the book. I want to give enormous credit to the editors and the designers at Princeton University Press. This is a beautifully produced book that was very complicated to produce, in part because there are so many quotations and there are so
yes.
many footnotes. It's much more typical in an academic book. It's simpler when you construct an academic book to put the notes at the end of the book. That way you don't have to monkey around with them on the same page. And it simplifies the design process. They were willing to put the notes on the same page, which is time consuming and more expensive to produce. But in terms of allowing you to glance at the bottom of the page and then look back at the top of the page, it's much more efficient. It allows a kind of dialogue to transpire on the page. So I really love doing that. And I'm enormously grateful to the design team at the publisher that was willing to do that. And then they also allowed me to include a section at the end of the book, which is kind of a further reading section. Like, if you'd like to learn more about the topic of this chapter, I found this really helpful or this inspired me. So it is I'd like to think it's a very dialogue-oriented book that is trying to bring a lot of voices into play simultaneously and ideally draw the reader's voice in too and have them feel like they're part of an ongoing conversation.
You succeeded. And on behalf of myself, and because I know what it's like to design publication, I want to say also thank you. I am
yes.
very grateful to your designers because as a reader, it was so much easier to look at the footnotes as I'm reading because I'm also a bit of a lazy reader these days. If I have to look
mm-hmm.
up and go back to the page, I probably won't do it just simply because
mm-hmm.
I get lazy after a while. But that kind of brings
mm-hmm.
me to one of the quotes that you put in here. Not only was it by Samuel Johnson, who absolutely wins my top 10 writers award,
mm-hmm.
you wrote something that is so true for me especially. The greatest part of a writer's time is spent in reading. In order to write, a man will turn over half a library to make one book. And I've been involved in a lot of writers' organizations, and I actually founded my own writers' group. And that's one of the things that I've always stressed. If you want to write, you must read.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's so important. You could not have written this book if you were not a reader, because you have so much richness in here from so many different scholars, I guess is the word I'm looking for.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I think you're right. I mean, that I love that Johnson quotation for exactly that reason, which is that it's acknowledging that we, you know, as Ralph Waldo Emerson said this in one of his journal entries, first you read, then you write, that in some ways your own thought is in dialogue with your predecessors. Now, this book is very overt about that. You know, it's you could say it's kind of over the top, or it's even, let's just say it's staging that process very overtly about having so many quotations and being explicit about acknowledging them. But I think all of us do it indirectly, and oftentimes maybe without even knowing it, that a word or a phrase that appeared in a novel or a poem that we read or in a conversation that we heard ends up kind of percolating its way into our own thought and our own speech. In some ways, that's something that the educators from Shakespeare's lifetime were very strategic about reinforcing on a practical level, where they were insisting that their students have a notebook where they would compile favorite words, phrases, paragraphs, passages from the writers they were reading, with an eye towards eventually having those words, phrases, paragraphs, passages percolate into their own writing, or even in some cases generate their writing, where you can, mm-hmm. you know, we have great examples of these books. They're called commonplace books. They're a type of notebook where you would accumulate material, and then that could inspire your further writing later on. So, and we have, and that's not unique to Shakespeare's era. We have them earlier from the medieval era, and we have writers to this day who do exactly that and gather favorite materials. So whether that's Virginia Woolf or Anne Frank or Lewis Carroll or George Eliot, we've got wonderful examples of brilliant writers who kind of create an archive or an intellectual trove of things that they love that then end up helping them shape their own creation ultimately.
I 100% agree with you on that, because I won't call myself a brilliant writer, but I will say that I have a file that I call memorable words. And mm-hmm. it can be something that I've read. It can be something that I've overheard. It could be something from a movie. But if it strikes mm-hmm. me on a visceral level, I go and write it in my journal, because one mm-hmm. day I will need it. I may change it. Mm-hmm. I may adapt it. Because I'm really good at revising the same paragraph three or four different ways. And that's part of my editing.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Well, this goes back to another longstanding principle in the history of rhetoric, or the history of verbal artistic creation, which was there are many words like this that I just love that I put in the book, because they're words from the rhetorical tradition or words from humanist education, where if you look at it one way, it means one thing, and if you look at it another way, it means almost the opposite thing. So one of these key practices from the rhetorical tradition that relates to what you're describing, Mary, is this word inventio. And we get two English words from that same Latin word, and you can imagine right away what one is. One's invention, mm-hmm. and another is inventory. And there's, in some ways, inventio is a combination of building up an inventory so you can eventually make an invention. And I think sometimes in the popular imagination, we presume that, you make an invention from scratch. You're just sitting alone and suddenly an idea comes to you. But in fact, if you interview most artists and in fact, scientific inventors, most of them will be very quick to credit and say, actually, it was because I was puzzling over this problem and reading over all these other things that somehow I began to assemble the pieces in my head, and eventually the invention came out of what I knew. So that word inventio is so great, because it captures that dynamic. Like, you do need to make mm-hmm. an archive or an inventory of insights or words or phrases. And then eventually it, you know, this is the magical part. This is the part that none of us really know how to describe, but there's a kind of alchemy or transition, and it becomes something new and it becomes something yours. But again, I love the fact that if you talk to scientists and inventors, they're very quick to say, you know, the best geologist is the one who's seen the most rocks, because that means they're able to recognize a new rock. Or the inventor of the laser says something very similar about, I read all of these other scientists who were puzzling over similar problems, and then it eventually came to me. But it's not that he or she invented it from scratch. It's because they were building up an inventory of other people's insights along the way.
Exactly. I don't remember who said it. You probably do. There's nothing new under the sun. I think that's a biblical phrase.
It is. That's right.
Mm-hmm. With an inventor or a scientist or computer programmer, whatever, cake baking, they're mm-hmm. having to start with, they all start with ingredients that are there before them. They didn't create those ingredients, mm-hmm. but they create them in a different way.
Mm-hmm.
I love
that's
that
right.
that you said that they give credit because they know that they have to. And I mm-hmm. have to take a break real quickly here. I'll be right back.
Are you tired of the same old, same old? Are you sick of having to switch from station to station to find something worth listening to? Well, honey, I've got the answer. AstronetRadio.com is the new kid on the block, and we're filling our slate with original music, entertainment reviews, sex talk, comedy, and so much more. So set your devices to stream AstronetRadio.com and never look back. We play what we want so you can hear what you want. AstronetRadio.com, serving East Texas and the world.
Welcome back. This is Mary. I'm here with Gene and Scott Newstock. Scott is a professor of English, and he wrote two books, right? I know you wrote Quoting Death in Early Modern England, and their newest one is How to Think Like Shakespeare, Lessons from a Renaissance Education. Are those the only two books you've got, Scott, so far?
Those are the only two that I didn't write them by myself, because they're full of quotations, as we were just describing, but
that you assembled.
Those are ones that have my name on the cover. I have a couple other ones that I edited or co-edited. I did a book with my friend Ayanna Thompson on the play Macbeth and different ways that that's been performed in relationship to race in American culture. I have another book that I edited based on a deceased writer named Kenneth Burke, who I mentioned in this book as well. And then I just finished this spring a book that was really a labor of love. My mentor at Grinnell College, my undergraduate institution, had been working on a book on John Milton's wonderful epic poem, Paradise Lost, and died suddenly. And his family, in conversation with his family, I offered to help edit that. And so that was just published this spring as well. So that, again, that's not technically my book. That was me helping someone else help bring their book into the world as an editor. But Mary, you're right. I do have two books that are officially mine that I didn't edit.
And interesting that how to think like Shakespeare really ties up what we were saying before the break, how inventors and scientists and programmers and whatnot have, they create something that appears to be new, but they're using components. And that's what you did. You created this book. It couldn't have been done if you didn't sit down and research and read and come up with all these quotes. You mm-hmm. also editorialized you didn't just throw a bunch of quotes in a book and say, here, read this. This is good stuff. You mm-hmm. wove it together and made it a beautiful work of art.
Thank you. That's exactly what I was hoping to do. So I really appreciate your saying that. And I think you're right that the book itself is trying to model that very practice that was characteristic of an education that Shakespeare would have had, which is surveying artists that came before you as well as are your contemporaries, and then finding ways to weave it together and making it new because you've assembled it in a new way, whether that's a collage or mosaic or whatever metaphor you want to use. You know, I do early in the book, I'm very clear about saying that very little that I say here is new, but hopefully the way in which I said it is a novel combination, and it's appropriate for this moment in time.
Well, what I found really interesting, in the very beginning of your book, you talk about Shakespeare as a child.
Mm-hmm.
And because he came into popular, I don't know what the word is I'm looking for. I should know words. We in the 21st century, in the 20th century, where a lot of us started, we were introduced to Shakespeare as a grown adult, a grown man, fully, his works were done. You know, he was dead, and all we had were his many, many works. And that's how we think of him, it's a word that starts with P. Why? I don't know. I feel like I'm a kid in school again, and the teacher's there.
Like ancient past.
Prolific.
Like ancient past.
Yes. And we don't think in terms, well, it's the same thing with parents or grandparents or aunts and uncles. If you don't see your offspring or your I don't see my sister's children very often. When I see them again, they're all grown up. How'd that happen? The last time I saw you, you were 7 years old. You're supposed to always be seven. For us, thinking about Shakespeare, we think of him as an adult. So to think about that, to me, that was one of the most eye-opening things. And it was, what, Ken Robinson's, I think, TED Talk that you pulled this from? Whoever thought of Shakespeare as being a little boy?
Mm-hmm.
But you know he had to be.
Yeah.
Yeah, I do think you've pinpointed something that's really true, which is that, and this maybe is just the way teaching has to happen because we don't have enough time to delve into everyone's kind of developmental biography, but we do tend to teach things as if they are fully formed or fully self-coherent on an adult level, and that, you know, that happens even in the sciences. If you think about, let's just take math as an example, math is often taught as a kind of series of self-evident axioms and theorems, whereas, you know, all of those things that we now take for granted as being self-evident came out of someone who was struggling with trying to solve a problem, that Euclid was trying to puzzle out, how do I figure out the area of a triangle? And so in some ways, if you can read Euclid and see a human being that's struggling to puzzle out this problem, that I think that makes it more apprehensible because you are a human being struggling to puzzle out a similar problem. Where if you can read Newton and see Newton puzzling out, how do I figure out the, you know, accelerating speed of a falling object? That makes it seem less remote and less monumental and less distant from us, less like a statue and more like, wow, this is a talented human being that did amazing things, but they still are a human being. And I think the more you can try to work your way back into someone's intellectual formation or their artistic formation, the more exciting it is. In my experience, the more their creation that they do as a mature person looks that much more impressive to me. That's kind of how I approach teaching any figure if I have the time and luxury to kind of work through some of their earlier works and then conclude with their more mature works is to think through, okay, you might know Paradise Lost as this untouchable monument, an epic, but let's look at these early poems where Milton was really struggling and they're not all great and they're uncertain, and he's writing a letter to his dad about how he doesn't know what he wants to do with his life, and that kind of sounds like a college 20-year-old student that's trying to figure out what she wants to do with her life. So I think the more you can kind of work your way into some of the challenges that every individual faces as they come to their maturity, the more you can appreciate the achievement that they had. And you can also recognize what went into that achievement. It doesn't look like an alien thing. It looks like, wow, someone spent a long time working towards this thing, which I love, and I love it even more the more I know about their own trajectory.
And I think it's important that we...
Interpretation.
Yes.
I was going to say, interpretation, you know.
I think it's important that we put the human back into humanity, whether it's someone who lived 400 years ago or 4 days ago. And that's something that people forget about.
Yeah, and I think, you know, I think Shakespeare has a particular burden as a kind of over-revered cultural figure. You know, in part, reading Shakespeare becomes much more complex and rich and powerful when you're reading his predecessors and peers and successors. But that's not often the way that he's taught, in part just, again, because of time. A teacher will assign, you know, one play from Shakespeare in a ninth grade English class and then no other contemporaries for 200 or 300 years later. All of a sudden you're reading, which is not a bad thing to be reading 20th century or 21st century literature, but it kind of places that particular figure in a almost like on an island as being incredibly remote. If you're not looking at all on the people that he was reading, the people that read him in the 400 years since he was writing. So I think that's it. Again, you know, we never have enough time to do everything we would like in any class or any curriculum, but there is a really unfortunate and in some ways damaging way in which we lift Shakespeare up on the pedestal and kind of disregard or skim over 400 years of writers between him and our current present.
Yeah, I think that's real common in history.
It is, and it's common. I mean, it's common in the Common Core. I don't know how much you're familiar with the requirements of the Common Core literature standards, but they made an odd decision to. It looks like they deliberately chose not to name any authors that you would recommend in a high school curriculum, except for Shakespeare. So,
interesting.
You know, and my preference would be either you name no one, or you name hundreds of authors that you think are worth the while. But that's an odd status to hyper elevate one single figure and then name no one else whatsoever. That's troubling. That it shouldn't be like that. And it actually, I think, is unhelpful for reading Shakespeare because it does turn him into a foreign or alien or distant or intimidating figure
isolated.
Rather than. Yeah, isolated.
Isolated.
You're totally right. That's the word. And it's not good. It's not good for Shakespeare, and it's not good for the rest of the curriculum either.
No, and it's not good for the students. They need to be exposed to more.
Yeah, and again, one of the things that I hope the book is trying to underline is kind of going along with what you were saying, Mary, is seeing him as a human creator, just like I think any scientist that you're reading or any historian that you're reading, part of what makes them appealing is thinking about them as another human being that's not alien from you, that is attainable, that is someone that you can relate to and you can connect to. So, you know, I spend a lot of time in class just trying to slow down and look at individual passages or phrases and help students think their way into the kind of thought that would have constructed that passage or phrase in that way, rather than I tend to be a much more kind of micro level teacher, a detail oriented teacher about words, phrases, lines, rather than a kind of macro oriented teacher about larger kind of plot or thematic things. But I think that helps make the language more apprehensible, more intelligible, because you're unpacking it on a very minute level, on a very local level. And it doesn't seem so monumental or as Jean was saying, so isolated in that way.
Well, and it sounds like from how do you describe it is that you're teaching someone how to approach that work and be able to use those skills to approach more of that same work.
Yes, I hope so.
Understand how.
I hope that's the case. And I also hope that, you know, one thing I do in parallel with that is I do the best as best as I can. Again, we're all
finite and we don't have time to do everything, but as best as I can, I do try to select different responses to the things that we're reading in the 400 years since that thing was written. So, you know, that I end the book by nodding to a brilliant essay by James Baldwin, Why I Stopped Hating Shakespeare. And I just can't recommend the essay enough. It's an incredible essay. And in some ways it stages the resistance that all of us have to feeling like we're forced to read something that feels distant and alien and not connected to us. And Baldwin stages a brilliant, powerful transformation that he had in his own autobiography of reading, where he felt that hatred or he felt that resistance, and then went through a transition where he began to see Shakespeare as part of his inheritance and something that belonged to him as much as it belonged to anyone on the planet, and then eventually kind of sees himself as one of Shakespeare's peers or one of Shakespeare's equals. So if I, you know, if that can be the trajectory that I'm able to help a student work through in their own reading, that's, I feel like my work is done. That's no small thing to be able to go through that transition. And but the Baldwin, again, the Baldwin essay, I closed the book with the Baldwin essay because it is just brilliant and it is incredibly, you know, it's typical Baldwin in terms of being searing and hard hitting and emotional and frank and self-critical and world critical, but also very loving and very, very inspiring by the end of the essay. So even if you don't read the book, I hope whoever's listening ends up reading that Baldwin essay, Why I Stopped Hating Shakespeare. It's just a brilliant, brilliant essay.
Well, I'll make a trip up to get that book, Mary, this week probably.
Okay. Well, yeah, you pass by my house every time you go to Titusville.
Yeah.
Gene and I live in different areas of the same county.
Okay. Yeah, close. But I just hear it's, to hear you talk is fascinating. I love your teaching philosophy. I wish I could like come and take your class maybe.
Yeah.
The one where you were talking about the Midsummer Night's Dream.
Right. Yeah, I'm really lucky. You know, I teach at a small college and I have a lot of flexibility in what I teach. You know, I don't teach graduate students, but I have a lot of freedom from my colleagues in my department and dean and provost and president to teach pretty widely. So I'm teaching a first year writing seminar right now, and I'm loving that. And then next semester, I'm going to offer a seminar that's focused on just a single play. I've done that a couple of times before. The Macbeth book is kind of in that same spirit. I have done that for Hamlet too. But next semester, we're going to look at Midsummer Night's Dream and look at its sources and look at some of its contemporary cultural parallels from the 16th century in folklore traditions, and then look at the long history of adapting and reading and responding to the play, whether it's on stage or on screen or in an opera or in a jazz adaptation. It's just a really fun way to use, again, kind of the hook of one play and then radiate outwards from it across different disciplines, across different historical periods, across different genres and different media. So I find that a really fun way to teach.
Sure. That was one of my favorite classes were the cross list, where I would go in with one viewpoint and other people with completely mm-hmm. different viewpoints would come in and we'd talk about the same piece of work.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, I like critical thinking.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's another Renaissance pedagogy that's very much like what you're describing, Gene, where this is the great theologian and translator and humanist intellectual and educator and advocate was Isidarius Erasmus, the great Dutch intellectual. And one of the many things that he recommends in his pedagogical practice in the early 1500s was to have students argue as strongly as they possibly could for a position that they believed in fervently. And then after they've written that essay, tell them, okay, well done. Now argue the opposite of that. Argue exactly 180 degrees in the other direction. And
wow.
You know, I'm sure that's frustrating for the student initially, but it ideally you would hope that it would help you become a more flexible and nimble thinker and recognize the complexity of any topic. The cynical version would be, this is exactly what Socrates hated about a certain kind of thinker, which is that they would argue any side and they don't care what the truth is. That's not the goal of what Erasmus was recommending, but you can see how that would be a danger of that kind of pedagogy, which is you can argue anything and you don't believe in anything. Ideally, you believe in a more complex sense of the truth that's more nuanced, and that emerges out of forcing yourself into kind of different subject positions of like, well, I don't actually think this, but I'm going to try to think like this to imagine what it would be like to think the opposite of the way I think. And then ideally you know, maybe your own thinking becomes refined and more subtle and I would hope a little more sympathetic to that other position, even if you're not won over to that other position.
Exactly. And maybe it takes you from the all, you know, everything is purple, no, everything is yellow, into something that's
right.
A blend of the two.
One would hope. I mean, I think you can see, in a funny way, you know, here's the deal. Shakespeare was not trained in creative writing. He wasn't even really trained in English. He was mainly trained in Latin in his schooling curriculum. But a lot of the practices that he did in that Latin curriculum made him a better writer of English, and it made him a good dramatist. It turns out to be some of the best creative writing training he could have had, because he knew how to argue multiple sides of a position, which is a lot like two people arguing on stage about a contentious topic. In some ways, that's like an embodied version of the Erasmus pedagogy strategy that was being recommended. So there are many cool examples of that where you can look back into pedagogical practices from the 1500s and you can see, oh, wow, that actually is very similar to what he ends up doing in this scene here in this play, or this in imagining mm-hmm. yourself like a, you know, so the one typical exercise was asking a little 10-year-old boy to imagine a different subject position. Like, for example, the mother of a son who was killed in the Trojan War. And like, you know, how it's almost impossible to imagine a more different subject position, someone who's older, a different gender, living in a different era and a different nation and a different civilization. But again, weirdly, that probably helped train that generation of writers to be really great playwrights who could write compelling, powerful, convincing women as well as they could write compelling, powerful, convincing men and boys and Italians and, you know, you name it, the kind of a world of characters was encouraged by that kind of practice of seeing multiple sides of the same topic.
One of my favorite exercises is to write in the perspective of another person that's not my gender. And it doesn't mm-hmm. matter what their preference is. You know, usually it's a guy. Sometimes it's a trans person. But it's amazing when I read it to the group, because they'll be halfway through it. Wait, is this a man or a woman?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, well, let's find out. Just keep reading.
Mm-hmm.
And it really
and
challenges your brain. It makes you think differently.
I think it does. And at the same time, you know, we all acknowledge that that's complicated, and that's a thing that has to be done, you know, thoughtfully and ethically, as I'm sure you do. Like, you're not trying to say that you know everything about someone else's subject position.
No.
But you are working as best as you possibly can to try to occupy or try to think your way into that subject position. Again, we know that this has been very contentious in the creative writing world in the last, you know, decade or so, where there have been, you know, enormous protests against saying someone can't do what you just described, thinking through a different subject position or different gender preference position. I would like to think that there's a kind of a complicated middle ground between either saying like you can only write about yourself, or no, you have the right to write about anybody and there's no qualms about that. Like, I think all of us would like to, or I think that a more complicated middle ground is something that we're aiming for, which is kind of ethical, a self-reflexive thinking through what's at mm-hmm. stake when you are writing like someone else.
I also write from the perspective of my cat, which is really weird.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But I do it mm-hmm. as a mental practice more than anything else. It's just mm-hmm. a way for me to expand my own sympathies, basically. It's easier if I can put myself in someone's shoes and see what they're possibly thinking, and I can explore it, and then if it works, great. If it doesn't, you know, I can always throw it away.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And ideally, I think I would hope that practice of imagining yourself as your cat might help you think about articulating what you care about that much better when you come back to yourself. I mean, that's kind of the premise that we think about when we talk about physical activity and physical cross training in athletics. I bring up the example in my book of how my college track coach would have us do all these kind of really goofy exercises where we would do everything except for running in a straight line. We would run backwards, or we would run hop skipping, or we would run kind of sidestep scissors. Like, the idea being not that we would ever do that in a race, because we would lose the race by doing that, but by stretching ourselves out of our normal comfortable zone, then we actually were stronger when we came back into our conventional
yes.
comfortable zone.
It helps you manage the unexpected. Just like in The Karate Kid, where Mr. Miyagi had Daniel doing all of his chores, but he was actually teaching him how to do karate.
Yeah, you asked me before about, you know, what didn't make the cut in the book. One of the anecdotes that I thought about bringing in, I didn't have enough space to really elaborate it, was a German philosopher named Eugene Herigel, who wrote a book called Zen and the Art of Archery, and his experience is very similar to that Karate Kid experience that you're describing, where he traveled all the way to Japan to apprentice himself to a master, and he actually spent the first couple of years never touching a bow and arrow. He wanted to learn about archery, but he was expected to do all of these other kinds of practices. And then even when he finally was given the bow, was not given an arrow and not given a target. And at one point, probably 3 or 4 years into it, he recounts losing his temper with the master and saying, you know, when are we going to shoot? When are we going to start shooting at the target? And the master, this is the great kind of punchline of this long anecdote here, the master looks him in the eye and says, come back at night. And so he comes back at night, and it's entirely dark. And of course the master ends up hitting the target in the dark, splitting one arrow on top of the other. But then turns to Eugene Herigel and kind of berates him and says, like, you think that it's all about the shooting, but it's really about the form. It's really about all the things you need to do, the kind of ensemble of activities you need to do in order to achieve the form, to achieve the target. But fixating on the target is actually not the best way to hit the target. It's by doing everything else that you need to do right that you kind of flow your way into the right activity that you're aiming for. So I kind of use that. I use our fixation on targets as a conceit or metaphor about what I find troubling about a lot of contemporary education, which is fixated on kind of shallow and short-term targets rather than long-term, more complex, more holistic practices.
That reminds me of something in your book, and I didn't mark it because I didn't think I would bring it up, but it was something, and I know you'll know exactly what it is, about we have the internet. Why don't we just videotape a good professor and not hire everybody else, or something along those lines?
Yeah,
I thought,
that's an
oh
anecdote.
My gosh.
Yeah. Well, that's an anecdote from a U.S. Senator, Ron Johnson, out of Wisconsin, who basically said, why don't we just screen documentaries by Ken Burns rather than having teachers teach the Civil War or whatever the topic is. And it just seems to reveal a pretty narrow or thin, misguided sense of what education actually entails. You know, we do have the internet. In fact, we've had textbooks for hundreds of years. So, you know, there's nothing stopping anybody from picking up a chemistry textbook and learning chemistry tomorrow. So it's not the lack of information, you know, and that's true for any topic, that you can instantly find the information out there on any topic. So what's missing, you know, that's the education part. That's the part about someone who's knowledgeable, someone who's inspiring, someone who can help you set into a practice and disciplinary pattern that will motivate you, that will chide you when you're not doing well, that will help you be excited about it because they're modeling their enthusiasm, that will know when you're struggling and what a good step to take might be at that stage, will know how to kind of keep you from going down blind pathways. I mean, those are all the things that all kinds of teachers do in all kinds of marvelous different ways that are not just about information transfer.
Yeah.
And they do have to know stuff. You know, it's not that teachers don't know things. They do need to know things, but they have to have a really art or craft of all kinds of other human dynamics that exceed just the knowledge.
Well, I can't tell you how many.
Well, go ahead, Jim. If you're sitting in front of your class and you say something that made perfectly clear sense and the entire class looks like a deer in the headlights, you know that.
Yep.
But if you're remote,
yes,
you just keep going, you know. You have to stop and catch them and bring them all.
I mean,
we've all been, the whole globe has been stuck in remote learning on account of the pandemic. And I hope that one thing that's become more clear is exactly that point, which is it's not just about information transfer. It's a much more complex, wonderfully complex human dynamic, interpersonal dynamic that takes place in the classroom. So I am, you know, I am teaching on Zoom. I'm doing the best I can. My students are doing the best they can. And I give them tons of credit because they are all working hard, but it is just not the same thing as being able, just as you were saying, Jean, and being able to look out there and realize, like, wait, that didn't land. Nobody understood what I just said, and I need to slow down and find another way to get it across. Whereas when you're kind of in the Hollywood Squares grid on Zoom, it's hard to read their subtle facial cues. It's hard to register, unless you're doing it in a very kind of overt way where you raise your hand or you say something in the chat room, which is, you know, given the medium, it's about the best we can do right now. But it's just not the same. So I hope that we, you know, whenever we finally come out of this, some of the breathlessness about how technology is going to change education forever will be a little bit deflated, because everyone I know is not loving this and not happy about it.
No.
Everyone I know is doing
no.
the best they can. But I think everyone's, you know, my kids are having a hard time. Their teachers are having a hard time. My friends are having a hard time, even as everyone is giving it their best and being very creative in many cases about new ways to engage with each other. But I just want to be in a room around a table together. It's really basic, but it's so fundamental. It's so needful.
It is. That personal connection is where the education is, and that's where the magic lies. There's a lot of things that we can do remotely. I've always lived on my computer. Before we started Be Unique, I was a freelancer. I was a freelance writer. I was a freelance editor, and I really enjoyed what I did, but not as much as I did once we started this nonprofit. But there are times that I'll have a problem with a website or an application that I'm using, and I try to get some help, and all I can do is even an online chat would be better. There'll be like a contact box or a forum. Go find your answers here. I just want to talk to a human being. If my website goes down, I don't want to do the chat and be waiting for 15 minutes for a response. I want to call a phone number, have somebody on the other line that can answer my questions, walk me through what I didn't do right, because it's usually my fault, but it doesn't matter. I need that person there on the other side to make me feel like I'm a human being too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's in those interactions, the other person, if they're able to tailor their answer to your problem or your challenge, you really appreciate that. I mean, I'm enormously grateful in those moments when someone's able to walk me through the steps I need to do because they've because they've been listening, because they're attuned to what I'm trying to convey. They can tell where I'm fumbling, but they can tell what I've done right and what I'm not quite doing right. And that's mm-hmm. what you're describing, Mary, is that it seems like a basic customer service thing, but actually it's a very complex human exchange where it's a dialogue, and it's not just the exchange of information. It's something more than just information. And again, that's not to dismiss information, but we have a glut of information. What we don't have a glut of is that human dynamic. And that's, you know, in terms of teaching, that's labor intensive and it's costly. It doesn't scale up. You know, I can't give the attention that I give to my, let's say, 20 students in a seminar. I can't give that same level of attention if I was doing a 20,000 student online lecture. I mean, I could,
exactly.
there are some things that I could do in that format, but they're not the same things. And that's expensive. You know, it's not cheap for me to teach small classes, and it would save any institution money every time that you add another student or another 10 students or another 100 students or another 1,000 students. But I think there's something lost along the way when you do scale up at that massive scale. So in part, this, you know, behind all of this is kind of a very complex political question of how do we fund education and who gets access to this great kind of education, and how can we make that more egalitarian and distribute those resources more equitably. But I think if you look at, you know, one of my favorite quotes, it's hard to pick out a single favorite quotation from the book, but there's one that I really think gets to the heart of it, which is from John Dewey, where he basically says, what any parent wants for his or her own child, they should want for all children. So
yes.
whenever I hear somebody who, you know, Bill Gates, I would single out in this way, who will say things like, class size doesn't matter. It doesn't matter how large the student's class is. Well, okay, how about your kids, Bill Gates? Would you be happy with them in a kindergarten class of 35 students? I don't think so. So mm-hmm. If we look at what people do for their own children when they're wealthy, that's probably a pretty good model for what we should be doing for all children.
Yes. In fact, I just posted something on our blog about the organization Red Nose Day. I didn't realize it was, I thought it was just a day. It's actually an organization to help with the poverty issue. But they were talking about the inequality between, and how this came up with COVID. The children, we just assume everybody has access to the internet or something to access mm-hmm. the internet with. And there are mm-hmm. children all over the United States of America, not even mentioning the rest of the world, that either don't have internet, don't have computers or smartphones, or if the school district gives them one, their parents take them and sell them for groceries. So there are choices to be made, and people don't even realize if you're not in that position, you don't think about it.
Right, and I think that, I mean, here's the deal about online education. Who does it work best for? It works best for people who have good internet access, people who have the infrastructure for whatever devices they need in their home, people who have quiet space, which not everyone mm-hmm. has if you're crowded into small quarters, people who have fluency in the language that the material's being delivered. Frankly, the older you are, the better online stuff works. So, you know, in my experience, if I'm at a board meeting with peers that are my age for a nonprofit, you know, being in a meeting online is not that much different than being in person. There's still a loss there, but it's doable. The younger you are, the less that's the case. So, and a lot of these are exacerbated by the socioeconomic inequalities that you were just describing, Mary. So, you know, in some wealthy private schools, when they pivoted to online education in March, they were getting 100% attendance because of all of those resources that we were just describing. And then mm-hmm. in some, you know, under-resourced school districts in, say, urban Los Angeles, there were some large portions of students that were never showing up online for all of those reasons. And so, regrettably, remote pandemic world has, or I don't know, made clear, or it's exacerbated, but it's certainly exposed a lot of the pre-existing resource infrastructure or lack of infrastructure, and accelerated a lot of those gaps, unfortunately.
And
but again,
unfortunately,
I think if you come back to the premise that what someone who's wealthy wants for their kids, it should be, if we're in a democracy, you would hope that they would want that for everyone's kids. So whether that's small classes or great teachers or whatever the case might be, again, that's an economic issue, and that's a political issue, and it's an enormous ongoing set of issues. But I think it's disingenuous when you hear education reformers say class size doesn't matter, because it does. So
it does indeed. And
absolutely.
Gentlemen, we're down to the last 5 minutes of our show. Scott, would you tell everybody where they can follow you and where they can buy How to Think Like Shakespeare, Lessons from a Renaissance Education?
Well, they can't really follow me anywhere since I'm not on social media. I would hope that they would get a copy of the book and enjoy reading some of those footnotes and further reading that we were talking about earlier. The book's published by Princeton University Press, a great publisher. Again, I keep singing the praises of their designers and editorial team. And so it's available online on online shopping bookstores or on the Princeton website, or if you have a bookstore that's open, it might be there. I don't know where, what kinds of bookstores are carrying it.
Okay. Mm.
Well, I'm looking forward to reading it. I'll be picking up your copy. Thanks for loaning it to me.
Okay.
Yeah, and don't forget, it's a loan, buddy. Actually,
yeah,
you know, I read somewhere. I read somewhere that they said you should never loan a book, always gift it. Of course, that doesn't bode well for the library system.
Well, unless you want it back, you know, then I say you'll loan it.
You're going, gee, as much of a thinker as you are absolutely going to love this book. You really will.
All right. Excellent.
We
tonight. It's been excellent. Fascinating listening to you describe what Shakespeare. I have one quick question, if everybody doesn't mind. Something I've been dying to, just a quick. What do you think about the idea of, I was reading where these processes that Shakespeare used to create that other people did after his passing, some people are saying, and then it was all kind of bundled up into more of a tradition than just the man himself. Is there any validity to that? I'm just curious.
Well, there's something fascinating about that. Again, this is trying to get away from thinking of any writer or any creator as totally independent and totally monumental. So just to take a quick analog, you know, we know from Renaissance painting practices that a Renaissance artist would have a studio that they would have apprenticed in someone else's studio, and they would learn all of the kind of ways to master their craft, and eventually they would have their own studio, but they would employ lots of other people in that studio to collaboratively make whatever that studio made. But it was a group effort. That's not dissimilar to some aspects of the way theater worked in the 20 years that Shakespeare was working in the theater in two ways. One is a very clear way in which playwrights would sometimes collaborate on either scenes on a play or on a revision of a play. And we do know that Shakespeare did that early and late in his career. And we know that from title page evidence as well as kind of stylistic analysis. So there's a whole enormous fascinating field about how you figure that out and what counts as evidence and what doesn't count as evidence. So that's very overt when two people have their name on the title page, and this was co-written by Shakespeare and Fletcher. There's something that's more subtle than that, I think, which is, you know, Shakespeare had a unique relationship to his theater company, which was different than most other playwrights. Most other playwrights would write a play, sell it to the theater company, and have no relationship to the performance of the play or the ongoing production of the play. You know, Shakespeare was a part owner in his own theater company. He was an actor and also was a part sharer or part owner in his theater company. So he had an ongoing relationship with that company, with that group of actors, and with the business interests invested in it. So we also know, this is a different way of thinking about collaboration, but he would tailor individual characters or roles that he made to particular actors because he knew that that actor would be playing this part, and he could make jokes about, you know, this actor being tall and skinny, or this actor liking to do a lot of improv. And so it's
fascinating.
It is fascinating. And that's a different way to think about collaboration. That's not quite so overt as two playwrights co-writing a play, but there is a complicated give and take back and forth between, well, I need to do a little improv scene here because I know this guy is going to do this improv, whether I like it or not. But maybe I can actually write a joke about him not doing improv into his role, so he has to say that, and am I going to make fun of him as he's about to do that? So that's a subtle form of collaboration. Yeah.
Yeah.
A lot of great scholarship that's been done on piecing that out and trying to figure out which actors might have played which roles and which playwrights might have collaborated. But if anything, I think he probably is somewhat anomalous in not doing as much collaboration as some of his other peers. In some ways, collaboration was the norm, and he was somewhat unusual in doing it only, you know, 5 or 6 times out of a career of about 38 or so plays.
Wow.
Okay. Excellent. Well, thank you very much. I'm going to have to look at taking your classes.
Well, maybe in the remote world, there's no obstacles now in the remote world, I guess, except for remote tuition, you know. But
that's true.
Yep.
Well, I'm definitely.
Well, gentlemen,
we have come
to the end of the show. We really have. This hour just slipped right on by. Scott, thank you so much for joining us.
Yes.
I learned even more than I did when I was reading the book, so I'm happy.
Oh, great.
While my brain is absorbing education and knowledge, I'm soak up the TV very much. That's my cat's job.
It's a pleasure talking to both of you. Thank you so much for your time.
My pleasure. Thanks so much.
I can't wait to talk about your book with Gene after he's read it. Because I guarantee you there are going to be some take-a-break topics in this book.
We'll have to make that our topic. We'll make that a topic.
We can do that. Good night, everybody.
See you guys. Have a good
evening. Thank you. Good night.
Thanks again, Scott. Bye.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening this evening. We're happy you chose to spend this time with us, and we hope you learned as much as we did.
Every Thursday at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time.
And if you'd like us to invite you or someone you know to speak right here, just go to beunique.org and contact us there.
I'm still trying to wrap my head around the fact that our newly branded podcast has so many global listeners and that our website and magazines receive thousands of visitors each month. Let's put your brand in front of all those people. Mary can share the demographics with you. Contact her through the website. That's BUNEKE.org.